texts from emails, she's forgotten to call the landline when Cherry's at home. The signal is weak and her mother's voice is full of crackles. Cherry, says her mother, I'm worried about you. Have you found a job yet? I'm fine, Mum, don't worry about me. You need to sort things out, darling. What are you waiting for? Mum, says Cherry, you're breaking up. I can't hear you. And she hangs up. The signal is often bad in Korokoro, which mostly consists of the Korokoro Road, winding up the hill in a series of hairpin bends. From the top, you can look down to the choppy water below and the flat warehouse roofs of Lower Hutt. At weekends, the millipede of a triathlon sometimes skirts the bay shore. Three times a day, a little bus chugs up the hill. It's often empty because most people in Korokoro own cars. Cherry owns a car too, but some days she doesn't use it, and then she takes the bus or walks down Galbraith's Gully, its switchbacks even more vicious than the road to the station. In the language of the people who named it, Korokoro means gullet or throat or windpipe. The house rests against the hill, propped up by stilts that hold the bedroom and a wooden deck level with the rest of the building. A carport nestles between the hill and the front door. Cherry drives her car up the steep driveway into Mount Victoria, where she looks down at the bay and the dangerous white tips of the waves. No ferries will be running back to Hutt today. On the highway, returning to Korokoro, a billboard tells the drivers of passing cars that they're just yards from the Wellington fault line, along which half the city itself was thrown into existence in 1855. Cherry looks at herself in the mirror, and of course she doesn't see what she looks like, but rather the difference between how she looks now and how she looked 10 years ago. If you peered over her shoulder, you would see a pale, Scott-skinned face with a scattering of freckles. Not too broad, but perhaps a little long. You would see hazel eyes topped with dark but spare brows and a slash of artificially reddened hair falling from crown to cheekbone. Her lips are also red, and the cherry in the mirror skims them with her little finger from left to right. Tests the lipstick. Whatever she does with makeup only makes her look more like herself. Though it sometimes sounds like a ridiculous qualification, even to her, Cherry has a PhD in philosophy. When she was six, she asked her grandmother what philosophy was. Her grandmother said, someone's philosophy is just their way of seeing the world, what they believe. Mr. Crabtree across the road, he sees himself right, doesn't ask anyone for anything, helps people when they need help. That's his philosophy. It's a good one. Cherry decided there and then that philosophy was what she would study, but by the time she knew enough to dispute the definition of terms, her grandmother was dead. Not long after this conversation with her grandmother, she fell over and scraped all the skin from her right knee. If she touches both knees now at night, after she's brushed her teeth and before she puts on her pyjamas, the right one is both smoother and knobblier with scar tissue. They could only be her own knees. She remembers the pain, the crying, and her mother's comforting kisses, but she also remembers the moment when the ground was no longer there, when, for the first time in a short life, the order of things, ordained by gravity, up and down, one foot in front of the other, staying upright, betrayed her. At 19, she got the drunkest she had ever been, and after the vomiting, embarrassment, and tears, when she was put to bed, she felt the mattress itself spinning and tilting uncontrollably, refusing to remain still long enough for her to plunge into sleep. When she told her classmate Barry about it, he said that if you put one foot out of the bed and touch the ground with it, the spinning will stop. Though she's never been that drunk again since, and even today can't bear the smell of Bacardi, she often has her foot poised, ready. Cherry thinks about faults in things and faults in people. She remembers the disaster journalist, his strangely wide hands and how they touched her, the moustache of sweat that always seemed to cling to his upper lip, even in the middle of a London winter. When Cherry lived in London, it didn't bother her that English people mistook her for an Australian. Few things are more tedious than an argument about toffee pops and Tim Tams. She could even deal with the occasional backpacker who'd been to New Zealand and thought he knew the deal with the long white cloud and fush and chups. She quickly felt at home in London. As soon as she had a travel card, she belonged to this beautiful, mad city of foreign languages and strange food. Just another arrivee finding her way. In time, it did come to bother her that rather than feeling far from home, she felt from far away, somewhere distant and irrelevant. In a graduate seminar on the political map, someone showed a slide of MacArthur's Universal Corrective Map of the World, in which the poles are reversed and Australia takes a symbolically dominant upper central position. Even on this map, New Zealand looked like an afterthought, Australia's lonely parenthesis. Aotearoa, she sang to herself, jewel of the southern sea. But in amongst the traffic and the people, the buses and the trains, the glass and the steel and the concrete, she was less sure than ever. She taught Kant and Schiller to skinny undergraduates and rented a room in Stoke Newington on the second floor of a large Victorian house. Church Street was nearby, a constant flux of three-wheeled pushchairs and chubby young fathers papoosing their young about. In the summer, sunlight came through a window in the roof. There was a slim terrace between the bricks and the tiles where she could step outside and feel the sun on her skin. There was central heating on a timer, an unimaginable luxury for a girl who'd grown up in a house heated by a wood-burning stove. And though the winters were tougher, she loved the city's sheen of ice. Coming home late at night, she drew hearts and round smiley faces in the frost on car windows, as well as her own personal logo, a smiling cherry, its stalk paraboling cheerfully upwards like a firework. Eduardo came from a wealthy and eccentric Colombian family who'd sent him to public school in England, where he'd acquired a profound contempt for the English upper classes and a perfect talent for aping their manners. After returning to Colombia and finding that he hated his family almost as much, he made his way via Spain to a job in humanitarian journalism, where he analysed the world's disasters, matching photographs of crying mothers to wire reports from earthquake zones, and writing terse summaries of long-running African civil wars. Cherry loved his double-worldliness, the sense that together they slipped through the membranes that kept other people apart. One weekend they would travel west to a dinner party with his old school friends, where stocks and politics were jokingly dismissed in cavernous Notting Hill reception rooms by people who could afford to be frivolous about what they owned. The next weekend she would don savage stilettos as he called a minicab to take them to Walthamstow's Greyhound track, where he bet almost all he could afford and then scattered the shreds of his losing slips by the trackside, swearing like a Spaniard. None of these were his worlds, and all were. He was the perfect chameleon. And it happened to her too. Nobody cares about your backstory in London. Nobody wants to read your hinterland. She got over the accent, got over the awkwardness, and became part of something else. Every neighbourhood is a new story, and you stop looking for the place that's just like it was back home. Eduardo and Cherry, from somewhere else, living here and now. Just another London couple. Cherry never saw the face of the kid who mugged her. It was hidden somewhere in the folds of his hood, and in her nightmares he sometimes had no face at all. She could hear his voice saying, "Don't be stupid, don't be stupid, don't be stupid." And it seemed unfair that he was blaming her for being stupid enough to get mugged when he was the one mugging her, until she realised that she was still holding onto her bag, pulling it away from him, and she let go. He ran and she fell awkwardly, twisting her ankle. As she sat on the ground and blood raced to her cheeks, before anger gelled, before she pulled herself to her feet and hobbled the 300 metres to where she could call the police, before she called a cab to casualty where they strapped and numbed her sprained ankle, before she returned home and found the time to cry, she wondered where he was from, this kid who had levelled her and then evaporated. His voice hadn't sounded English, but she couldn't place the shapes of the vowels, couldn't triangulate his accent. In the dreams that followed, along with the facelessness, the violence and the loss, she also dreamt that this young man had travelled a long way to mug her. Over mountains and seas, through great hardship, he had struggled to reach London, like all the other Aravis, and his dream had been of her. She called her mother. "Mum, I twisted my ankle." "Darling, how? Are you okay?" "I got mugged." There was a satellite lag and she could hear her own words echo back to her. "Mugged? Where?" She explained, close to her flat, out of the blue, the police hadn't caught anyone. "London's a dangerous place," said her mother. "Are you sure you're safe? You can come home, you know, any time." "It's okay, Mum, it's not that drastic." "It sounds drastic. We don't have muggers in Wellington." "You know bloody well you have muggers in Wellington." "Not like in London, and your ankle, oh Cherry." "I'm fine now, Mum," she said. "I'm fine now. It's over." But her street wasn't the same. What had been charming and cosy was now close and oppressive. Glances weren't friendly anymore. Her peripheral vision didn't reach far enough. She started at phantoms. Eduardo did nothing wrong. He didn't pity her, patronise her, or make false likenesses. He just didn't understand. "It's tough now," he said, "but you will get over it." "I know," she said. "It's the tough now bit that's hard to deal with." "It wasn't personal. Nobody's out to get you." "But it happened to me." "You're no less safe now than you were before." "But I feel less safe, and that's worse." "This is not the worst thing that will ever happen to you," he said. Worse things had, of course, happened to Eduardo. He'd been mugged before in Colombia and in England. He'd had a gun held to his head in Spain. He knew how these things worked. "If you don't die," he said, "you just have to live. Let's go out." When they did, it was still good. She wore a short skirt and didn't shrink from glances. But now she just felt protected by him. When his fearlessness belonged to him alone, it was a selfish, boy's own kind of recklessness. A disaster is not quite a tragedy. At school, Cherry was taught about continental plates, dangerous, slippery things that brought islands and mountains into existence and stuck cities into the ground. At first, she imagined that each country had its own plate submersed in the sea, and that everyone's plate bumped into each other in a jolly fashion, like a bath overcrowded with plastic toys. When she learned that New Zealand didn't have its own plate, but was itself the product of the clash between the Australian plate and the Indian plate, she felt a sudden sense of loss, as if something had been stolen from New Zealand and from her. Idly surfing the internet one afternoon in the shared faculty office, always thick with the yap of academic politics, she found that rather than merely checking the price of flights home, she was halfway through booking one and about to key in her credit card details. The next day she did, and the hell with it anyhow, without asking her mother, without telling Eduardo. She gave herself just 3 weeks to wrap it up, to go to all those art galleries she'd meant to, and sit in cafes along the river, sketching the buildings. She packed the gallery guide, sketches, photos and a handful of keepsakes into the warm woolly jumper she'd never worn, and zipped the case shut. Eduardo was reproachful rather than upset. "You don't need to go," he said. "You don't need to be afraid." "It's not that," she said, "not that at all." "Then what?" But she couldn't explain. So instead, she walked him to the bus stop, where he kissed her hard and asked her one more time not to go. When he got on the bus and sat down, he wouldn't look at her through the window, and the last Cherry saw of him was his broad lips forming a pout. Everything reverses itself in the transoceanic flight. Night becomes day, summer becomes winter. Cherry's last proper view of London was dirty cherry blossom overhanging the platform at Austerlitz. By the time she arrives in Wellington, spring is a distant memory, the forecast for rainy Tasman winds. The first thing she does is visit the big new museum downtown, built on land thrown up from the sea in 1855. The museum, to Papa, contains all manner of irreconcilable things: a reassembled Māori Whānui, a sheep-shearing demonstration, and New Zealanders' attempts at modern art. In the basement, there's an exhibition which shows how the entire building stands on special earthquake feet. These inertial dampers, multi-layered sandwiches of steel and rubber, will slow the frantic vibrations of an earthquake. The building will merely lurch as if it were drunk, rather than shake as if it were epileptic. Staying with a mother is more than she can bear. Moving into the tiny but trendy post-divorce flat on the Keys would be sharing too much defeat. Barry's taking 6 months out to trek in Vietnam. The house in Korokoro needs looking after. Heavy English pounds in her bank account are converted into a satisfactory number of Kiwi dollars. She can afford not to work for a while. She can afford to take some time to reflect, figure things out. She looks down on the cloud-lashed landscape and thinks. Some things make her glad to be back. The familiar parade of shops along Lambton Quay and the funicular railway running up the hill, the bars on Cuba and the multicoloured bucket fountain all give her a sense of being in the place that must be home. But it's only in suburban Korokoro, where she's never lived before, among Barry's boxes and poor sense of interior decoration, that she finally feels as if something, somehow, might resolve itself. She sees her mother once a week for coffee at a gallery, maybe shopping. She never invites her to Korokoro. Her mother isn't the worrying kind as such. She prefers the world to work in her favour, but Cherry is sand in the oyster, like a pregnancy all over again. Still, she's unable to explain what happens next. "Cherry, darling," says her mother, "you just have to get on with it." When the quake arrives, it's as sudden as it is inevitable. Cherry is in the bedroom, half-dressed, struggling into her skirt when the hill below hiccups and pungas start flip-flopping like metronomes. Cherry's eyes are already through the bedroom door towards the deck and safety when it properly kicks off. The wooden floor beneath her feet falls away as the stilts concertina and the bedroom detaches itself from the rest of the house. An unassuming cardboard box flies from the top of the wardrobe and showers the room with pornographic magazines. The wardrobe itself hangs in space a moment, that surprises Cherry, and then flies back the other way. When everything comes to rest a little further down the hill, the wardrobe is pinning Cherry's leg just above the knee. She twitches her toes, tries to touch the ground with them. Her leg doesn't feel broken. She pulls her hip towards her, but the wardrobe isn't going anywhere, and neither is she. Barry's house, she thinks. What's he going to do without his house? She manages to twist herself around far enough to retrieve her mobile phone from her pocket. No signal. Cherry is 29 years old. Now she knows what she's waiting for.